Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host today while we go over what our this is really going to be sort of a jam-packed podcast. There have been a lot of stuff going on that I want to talk about, but I want to start on somewhat of a personal note. I'm recording this on January 2nd, the first Thursday of 2020. And I opened up the papers this morning. Opened up the papers, you still say that. I actually went to a whole bunch of news feeds on the internet, and the dominant story involving the public safety labor world is a photograph that has been posted on a social media account of a group of, it looks like about 25 or so, Detroit firefighters posing in front of a burned house. It looks like one of those end zone celebrations that you have in the National Football League that are now allowed. Only it's firefighters in their full turnouts, axes and everything, posing in front of a fully involved house. The head of the Detroit Fire Department has already announced there's going to be investigations and referred to the photograph and the act of posing for it as despicable. There are justifications that are being offered that the house was empty, thank goodness, that the house was far too involved to put out a fire, to do anything other than contain it and make sure it didn't spread. But I suspect those justifications aren't going to get in the way of discipline for those firefighters. Why the photo? They were celebrating the retirement of a battalion chief. Well, because we're at the start of the year and people, you know, historically make New Year resolutions, can I propose a couple of them dealing with social media? First of all, for all public safety employees who are out there, stop posting anything about your jobs. Stop posting anything about politics. We have seen hundreds of police officers, deputy sheriffs, troopers, firefighters get fired in 2019 because they wanted to share their innermost thoughts with the world. Social media posts are forever. And remember, there's no such thing as a private social media webpage. Just simply stop it. This is a good fulcrum, right? A good point on which we can turn the start of the new year and not have any more posts about the job or politics. And secondly, if you're going to post something on social media, make it positive. And I say this from a broader perspective than just the world we live in dealing with public safety labor issues. I say this from the perspective of the world that we're living in. There's just simply too much negativity. I'll vow myself, I'll go the entirety of 2020 without one negative social media post. Can we all do that? Okay, enough of that. On to the cases. And I want to start with a case out of California. It's a small police department, the Oakdale Police Department in California. They only have 22 officers, and they managed to conduct an internal affairs investigation that did just about everything wrong. And not only that, they actually hired a consultant to do it. As you know, small agencies don't always have a dedicated internal affairs or something like it department, so they will occasionally contract with an outside investigator. And so it was in Oakdale. So what went kind of spectacularly wrong in Oakdale? Well, this all starts on March 26, 2018. There's a lieutenant in the police department, and he's worried about how the video files from body cams are indexed. And he logged into the department system to check it out, and he brought his concerns to the police chief, a fellow named Scott Heller. And what they were poring over was an unusual file that had been marked delete. And what the file was, it wasn't deleted, it was just marked delete. What the file was a video clip from the body cam of someone who's identified in the report that I read only as Sergeant A. And what it contained was a video that where the body cam had inadvertently been left on during a morning roll call and briefing. And you know what? If you have a policy, a body cam policy, where the employer has the ability to randomly review videos for evidence of potential misconduct, these sorts of cases are going to happen, right? They're going to record interactions that are not positive interactions. It's just kind of inevitable. That's one of the downsides of that random review or trolling or trawling or whatever you want to call it sort of policy. Well, that's the policy they have in Oakdale. And so what do they see on this video? The video records Sergeant A, and again, this is during a morning roll call and briefing, and in the briefing room afterwards, it records Sergeant A saying something to the effect that Sergeant B, another sergeant, finally had his dream come true. What was the dream? He was able to arrest a black person. Sergeant A made this statement while holding up a picture of a symbol that was associated with white supremacy, suggesting that the picture belonged to Sergeant B. Sergeant A's comments related to an arrest that Sergeant B had made during the prior shift, where one of the suspects taken into custody was African American. There were other officers present in the briefing room, and the opinion I read calls them officers C, D, and E. So that's the misconduct that the Chief Heller sees on the video. What does he do? He retains an independent investigator to take a look into the conduct in the video. Well, I guess you can understand going out to an independent investigator in a case where you've got 5 of 22 officers who are captured on the video. No word as to how they found this particular independent investigator. So the investigator decides, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide these people up. And Sergeant A is going to be the subject of the investigation. Sergeant B and officers C, D, and E, I am going to label as witnesses. The investigator talks with the chief. The chief says, look, all the witness officers, the sergeant, Sergeant B, and the other three, I want you to give them instructions that they are not to discuss the investigation with anyone. Okay, let's stop. Let's pause for just a moment. Have things gone wrong already? Yeah, they've gone wrong already. They've gone wrong already in two ways, right? The first is that the suspect witness dichotomy that seemed to be in place here in Oakdale, that's actually irrelevant as to whether or not these officers are entitled to representation. Under the Weingarten rule, it's not the employer's designation of an officer or firefighter, who's ever being interviewed, as a witness or a suspect that matters. What matters is, does the employee reasonably believe they could be subject to disciplinary action? And if the answer is yes, they get a union rep. So I think it's really time, largely, to throw out this witness-suspect designation. Not only doesn't help, it leads employers down the wrong road. So that's the first thing that goes wrong. Secondly, the chief tells the investigator, order the witnesses not to discuss the investigation. As you'll hear me say in a few minutes, that violates California law and likely the law in every other state that has a statewide collective bargaining law. Okay, so The investigator then meets with officers C, D, and E, and Sergeant B gives them pretty much identical notices. It tells them they're not the subject of the investigation. It tells them they do not have the right to be represented during the interview. And it orders them not to discuss the interview or investigation with anyone. Now, I usually don't have my union lawyer hat on when I'm doing these podcasts. I try to keep these things as neutral as I possibly can be. But on this occasion, let me put my union hat on for a moment. If an employer is going to violate the law, it's very helpful if they do so in writing. And I can just imagine the lawyer for the Oakdale Police Association, I guess it's Police Officers Association, POA there. I can just imagine the lawyer looking at this order where there is, in black and white, the employer says, you're not entitled to a union rep and you may not discuss this case with anyone. That sort of becomes Exhibit 1, right? That's what that document becomes. Okay, so the investigator goes on and interviews the various officers. When he gets to Officer C, he instructs Officer C that the no contact order that he has given them includes any union representative. Really? I mean, you cannot, even if you're going to insist on confidentiality because of the nature of the investigation, more on that in a moment, you can't exclude the employees from being able to talk to their union representative. That's protected activity under the law. You can't do that. By the time the investigator gets to Officer E, he not only tells Officer E, you don't get a representative. He says, you don't need a representative. And then he follows it up by telling Officer E, you can be disciplined if you're untruthful with this interview. Okay, now let's go back to Weingarten again. You're entitled to a representative if you reasonably believe you could be subject to discipline as a result of the interview. You tell an officer you don't get any representation because you're just a witness, and then you tell the officer, but we can discipline you if you're untruthful during the interview, and then you tell the officer again, but you don't get a representative. This is just sort of a lovely fact pattern, isn't it? Well, finally, the investigator interviews Sergeant A, and he orders Sergeant A not to discuss the interview or investigation with anyone. He makes an exception for Sergeant A's representative. Remember, Sergeant A is the suspect in this. And the investigator says, if you fail to obey my directive, the no contact order, that'll be grounds for discipline up to and including termination from employment. The association files an unfair labor practice complaint with California's Public Employment Relations Board. And it sort of says, I haven't bothered to go read the complaint, but I can imagine what it said was, they violated everything. Everything you can possibly violate about how to do an internal affairs investigation, they actually did it I can imagine. That's what the complaint would say, of course, because lawyers would probably write it. It would be much longer and involve billable hours, but that's pretty much what the complaint is going to say. It goes to an administrative law judge, and the administrative law judge says, really? This happened? Actually, the words that the administrative law judge used were, there is no more fundamental right afforded employees under the statutory collective bargaining scheme than the right to communicate with others about working conditions. Working conditions include the circumstances underlying and surrounding an investigation into alleged employee misconduct. The association has established a prima facie case that the city interfered with employee protected rights when it issued the confidentiality directives to both the percipient witnesses and Sergeant A, barring them from discussing the investigation with other employees. I'm not going to drone on and on about the rest of the ALJ's opinion. Suffice it to say, he finds the obvious Weingarten violation and says, it really doesn't matter if you're calling them witnesses, if they reasonably believe they could be disciplined, and your behavior in this investigation, employer, leads them to believe that they could be subject to the disciplinary process. I do want to conclude with a couple of other lines from the ALJ's opinion, and I think these lines are very important because the law here isn't that no contact orders are illegal per se. The law is that blanket no contact orders are illegal per se. A no-contact order may be appropriate, may be completely licit on a case-by-case basis, depending upon the investigation, right? You may have an investigation into something that is highly confidential. Perhaps it's an investigation where there's an allegation of a conspiracy among employees. It may well be that under some circumstances, you could have a legitimate no-contact order. What you can't say is, don't talk to anyone about this. Don't talk to any other employees, period. It's going to have to be a case-by-case determination. Now, how did the hearing officer capture that principle? He's got three sentences, or maybe two, they look long, that are worth reading. The city also seems to suggest that allowing the four percipient witnesses to consult with the association would have undermined the integrity of the investigation because its representative could have acted as a conduit between the witnesses. These general facts, without more, are insufficient to substantiate the city's concern that the corruption of its investigation was probable. It was incumbent on the city to look at the specific individuals involved, the specific facts presented, to first determine whether the witnesses needed protection, evidence was in danger of being destroyed, testimony was in danger of being fabricated, or there was a need to prevent a cover-up. In other words, you've got to do a case-by-case analysis before you issue a no-contact order. Could well be that you have five witnesses in an internal affairs investigation, and one of them, it could be that a no-contact order is appropriate for that one witness, a very carefully crafted one, right? It can't forbid the employee from talking with their union rep. It could be that you have one where the no-contact order is appropriate and four where it isn't. Employers, if you want to go down the road of no-contact orders, what you need to do is make sure that you've got a system in place to make that determination in advance. Now, I want to follow up on that briefly with some information from Washington, D.C., and in particular about the National Labor Relations Board. You may have seen some of this. In the month of December, the NLRB, which is now completely dominated by appointees from President Trump, the NLRB issued a series of rulings and decisions that are being referred to on employer-side blogs, written by employer law firms, as Christmas presents for employers around the country. And there's a whole range of these decisions, and they overturn a precedent that is years old and come up with new rules. And in every case, the employers won whatever it was the issue was. The NLRB is firmly pro-employer at this point. There's no question about that. And the cases involve things like, can you have a dress code policy that limits employees from wearing union insignia at work? That kind of mild little area. And, of course, the employer won that. There were all sorts of changes to election rules, making it far easier for employers to defeat a union election. And there's also, most importantly for the purposes of the discussion of the California case that I just talked about, the National Labor Relations Board issued a new decision that takes the opposite approach to that California's Public Employment Relations Board took, and takes the approach that you can have what the NLRB calls a facially neutral workplace rule that limits confidentiality to the duration of an investigation, a rule that says employees who are interviewed cannot talk to other employees about whatever the subject of the interview was. And what the NLRB does is to overturn the case-by-case analysis that I just told you came out of California and is likely the result in other states. So why am I saying that, we have the National Labor Relations Board, the preeminent labor board in the country, is going one way. Why am I saying we should expect the rule to be different out there under state collective bargaining laws? And I think the reason is this, is that state labor boards have just become fundamentally tired of the politics at the NLRB. It seems now like every time we get a new president, we get the president appointing people who are out there to, they perceive their job as to do the bidding of either employers or unions, and you have these wild swings in precedent where the NLRB is overturning cases, sometimes cases, for example, in this workplace investigation confidentiality issue, sometimes cases that are only 2 years old, they're overturning them. And they're not overturning them on the basis of new facts. It's just simply a different philosophy. And I think what state labor boards are saying, and you see them now increasingly rejecting precedent that's coming out of the NLRB, I think what state labor boards are saying is, you know, we don't know what's going on with you folks over there in Washington, but we need stability in our labor relations systems. And we're not going to get them if we simply bounce our precedent around like a political football exactly the way you are doing it. So I would firmly anticipate here that the fact that the NLRB has decided something different, that you can have this general workplace confidentiality rule, isn't going to impact one state labor board one little bit. I think they're going to continue to adhere to the old rules about confidentiality. While I'm talking about federal agencies, another agency that was busy and was busy in a way that was, it very clearly is friendly to employers, is the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor on December 12th of 2019 issued new regulations on how to calculate the regular rate of pay. To reset the regular rate of pay under the FLSA, Fair Labor Standards Act, that's the thing that gets multiplied by time and a half to produce the FLSA's overtime rate. And so the regular rate becomes very important as to what goes in it and what doesn't go into it. And the law forever has been that when you're computing the regular rate, you have to take into account all, and I'm quoting here, remuneration for employment. And so you see a lot of litigation about what's remuneration for employment? What goes into the regular rate? What is it you have to multiply by time and a half to get to the overtime rate? And the new regulations that the Department of Labor issued on December 12th basically say there's a whole lot of things you don't have to include in the overtime rate. In some cases, reversing decisions that the Department of Labor itself had made dozens and dozens of years ago. In some cases, taking positions contrary to those taken by federal courts of appeals. These are very controversial regulations in a lot of ways. But once again, it was Christmas in Washington, D.C. for employers, and this is another area where it was Christmas. So what is this particular present? What does this give to employers once they'd undone the wrapping? It says that these things don't have to be included in the regular rate. First, pay in lieu of holidays. So if you have an in lieu of holiday and you get paid for the time instead of taking the time off, even if it's paid at a later date, that doesn't get included in the regular rate of pay. Sick leave buyback payments. So you have a system where at the end of the year, you can cash out accrued but unused sick leave. If you don't use it, do you need to include the cash from those buyback payments in the regular rate? This is one where Federal Court of Appeals has actually said, yeah, you've got to include those in the regular rate. Department of Labor says no. The cost of offsite parking or wellness programs or gym access or fitness classes, the costs of those things don't need to be included in the regular rate. Employee discounts on retail goods and services don't need to be included. Tuition reimbursement doesn't need to be included. Employer contributions to health savings account don't need to be included. State or locally mandated payments or penalties like callback pay, show-up pay, that attach when, before or after returning to work as scheduled, the employee is not provided with the expected amount of work. So you show up and it's unclear how this would apply to overtime minimums, callback minimums that are a regular feature of public safety collective bargaining agreements. Reimbursements for business expenses, including a cell phone plan, don't need to be included in the regular rate. Organizational membership dues, exam fees, travel, even if not incurred solely for the employer's benefit, does not need to be included in the regular rate. Signing bonuses don't need to be included in the regular rate. And they even got into things like office coffee or snacks provided to employees as gifts, not included in the regular rate. Employer contributions to benefit plans for accident, unemployment, legal services don't need to be included in the regular rate. So a whole slug of things that don't need to be factored into the overtime rate under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And now, unlike what the NLRB has done, these regulations, I do think, are going to have an impact in public safety labor world, because some of these payments are now being calculated as part of overtime by the employer. They're, in fact, built into these off-the-shelf payroll systems that you get because they've been the law for so long. They've been the law in some of these cases. It's been the law for decades. At any rate, if you're in the business of trying to figure out how to calculate overtime under the FLSA, go look up the Department of Labor's December 12, 2019 regulations. We'll post them on our website. Okay, let's talk about bargaining and Lexapol. Well, what's Lexapol? Most of you know, but some of you may not. Lexapol is a private company. It's out of California. And one of the things that Lexapol does is to write model rules. They actually sell these rules to various agencies out there around the country. And you can pretty much buy an entire policy manual or many portions of a policy manual from Lexapol. And one of the sections that Lexapol will give you, if you want, are standards for conduct. So what am I talking about Lexapol for? Well, remember that an employer has what's known as a continuing duty to bargain. That means before it makes changes in a topic that is mandatory for bargaining, it's got to negotiate those changes with the union. It has to provide notice of the intended changes. And then if the union demands to bargain the changes, it has to sit down with the union and talk about them if the changes impact wages, hours, or negotiable working conditions. This continuing duty to bargain applies even when you've got a contract that is in effect, a collective bargaining agreement that's in effect. Unless, for some reason, there's something in that contract where the union has waived the continuing duty to bargain. And most collective bargaining agreements in this country do not waive the continuing duty to bargain. Or if they do at all, they only do so for some very narrow topics. So how does all this come up? Well, it comes up in Snohomish County, Washington. Snohomish County is the county that is just north of Seattle in Washington's Puget Sound. It's a pretty large employer, Snohomish County is. Prior to 2018, there was no one place where employees of the Snohomish County Corrections Bureau, that's the jail system in Snohomish County, there was no one place where employees could find all of the workplace policies and procedures. There were two policy manuals, always helpful to have two rather than one, right? One that dated from around 2006 and the other from 2009. Each of those contained some policies and SOPs that remained in effect until 2018. In addition, the county had a file-sharing platform that contained other policies and directives. And because all of these policies are so decentralized, sometimes employees had to actually search their email to figure out what policy applied to a given situation. So, clearly a mess. Clearly, the county needs to fix this. And what it does is to go down to Lexapol and they come up with a new 900-page policy manual. They've used the generic Lexapol policy manual as a template, and almost all of what they implement is verbatim out of the Lexapol policies. The union representing the employees in the Corrections Bureau, it's called the Snohomish County Corrections Guild, files an unfair labor practice complaint with Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission and says, hey, look, continuing duty to bargain. These policies concern working conditions. They concern, in some cases, hours of work. You've got to negotiate over it. The county's answer is, there's a real core issue here. We don't think we have any obligation to bargain these policies. This is our manual. We think that we don't have to bargain anything about it. All it is, says the county, is a restatement of our existing policies and practices in new language. And the county says we didn't intend to enforce new language that changed anything, even though there is some in there. We didn't intend to enforce that, and we certainly don't intend to change our practice. So this all goes to a hearing officer for Washington's PERC, and Washington's PERC says, oh, look, let's cross a threshold here to begin with. Are we going to look at this policy manual as a whole, the 900 pages, and say, yes, you have to bargain, or no, you don't have to bargain over the whole thing? Or are we going to look at it on a policy-by-policy basis? And you could almost hear the hearing examiner exhaling a long, long sigh and saying, quite correctly, we're going to have to look at it on a policy-by-policy basis. And the reason is that there's going to be many things in a policy manual. Most of a policy manual is not going to be negotiable because it's not going to affect wages, hours, or working conditions. And that's why a policy-by-policy approach is so important. The The hearing officer then crosses the next threshold. And what's the next threshold? Is this policy manual a significant enough change to warrant bargaining? And the hearing officer says, look, county, when you tell me that, did you even, like, read what you wrote? Here's a phrase, says the hearing officer, out of the Lexapol manual. And tell me, county, why you think this isn't a negotiable working condition. The phrase, quote, your job, your future, and in many cases, your family's future and security depends upon your compliance with these policies, rules, and procedures. All members are to conform to the provisions of this manual. All prior and existing manuals, orders, and regulations which are in conflict with this manual are revoked, except to the extent an outside document covers subjects not covered by or in conflict with this manual. And then, drum roll, employees of the office shall be subject to disciplinary action in accordance with the provisions of this manual and for violations of the rules and regulations set forth herein. I mean, really? You're going to put that stuff in a manual? Let's go back to the first line. Your job, your future, and in many instances, your family's future and security depends upon compliance with this manual. This is like the employer is treating these corrections officers like children, right? And threatening them in that fashion. I want to know why they didn't include dogs in that, you know, the family's future and security. I think I'd, at least in our house, we'd be including our dogs in it. Okay, well, the hearing officer then turns to the specific issues where there were disagreements over negotiability, and the hearing officer finds a lot that is negotiable. For example, a new fitness for duty evaluation process is negotiable because it has some requirements for disclosure of confidential medical information. The hearing officer finds policies like how medical files are to be retained, what a drug testing policy looks like, finds all those things to be negotiable. The policy manual has language regarding workplace searches and whether lockers are private. That was a change in past practice. The hearing officer finds that all negotiable. Ends up looking at more than a dozen policies, finding some negotiable, some not negotiable. We'll post this decision on the webpage. On our webpage, in case you want to take a look at it, in case you have a Lexapol manual or a Lexapol manual is in your future. But in the end, the hearing officer ordered the county to rescind all portions of the Lexapol policy where there were mandatorily negotiable topics and to reinstitute the previous policies. A word about Lexapol, and Lexapol's not the only outfit out there, you know, that's engaged in the business of writing these policies. And I probably sound at least implicitly critical of Lexapol's policies. And really, I'm not. I mean, I do think they do a good job. They're pretty thoughtful about their policies. But what they're putting out there with their generic policy manual is just that. A generic policy manual. You can't blindly adopt the Lexapol policy for your agency. You're going to run into trouble when you do that because it's almost a certainty that the Lexapol or whoever else you buy your, you know, off-the-shelf policy manual from will contain provisions that would call for changes in wages, hours, and working conditions. If you're going to go to an off-the-shelf policy manual, you need to spend the time to look at the manual line by line, word by word, to make sure that it doesn't change the past practices in your agency. Or if it does, then you have to make sure, if you're an employer, that you're negotiating over those changes with the union. This is much like when you have an employer transitioning to a new payroll system. When you're in the process of doing that transition, you need to be checking what the defaults are in the new payroll system against the practices of the employer and the practices that are mandated by the collective bargaining agreement. Otherwise, you're going to run into trouble. Don't just buy these things off the shelf. I've got two more cases I want to talk about. They're both going to be very brief because they fall under the heading of reminders, I think, more than anything else as to what the law is. One concerns the standard for a fitness for duty evaluation, and the other concerns whether an employer is obligated to arbitrate over a Me Too grievance. So let's take the fitness for duty evaluations first. And by the way, just kind of as a news update, one of the books that LRAS publishes is called The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers. It's in its seventh edition. I'm in the process right now of updating it and taking it to its eighth edition. And it is a process that is just, I've got to tell you, it's almost mind-numbing. I am at least glancing at, and I wish I was making this up, but I'm not, tens of thousands of cases decided in the last 6 years involving the rights of law enforcement officers in the workplace, and then in some cases creating new chapters in the book, in other cases substantially rewriting chapters, and in other cases just simply supplementing what's in a chapter by newer cases and twists and turns on the law. And one of the areas where there's been a lot of action lately is in with respect to the legality of fitness for duty evaluations. So we have a new case that came out in the next in the last month, and it's a case that's going to be in the book because I thought it was a pretty important and a good reminder as to what the standards are for this. So let's talk about it. This involves a police officer by the name of Brian Gibson. He worked for a small police department. It's called the Tawas, T-A-W-A-S, Police Authority. And he worked for a few years when he was in a serious car accident. And this is a car accident on duty. He hurt his back so badly, he couldn't come to work for over 6 months. When he did, he needed accommodation. His doctor wrote notes restricting his ability to lift over 25 pounds. The doctor said he could only work the day shift. The authority accommodated those restrictions, but Gibson's back didn't get much better. After a year, he went back off on medical leave for another 4 months. He then returns a second time, but his doctor says he can only do light duty. The authority tried to accommodate those limitations by putting Gibson on a temporary light-duty position where he could do the work that had to be performed without the need for heavy lifting. And when he'd been on light-duty for several months, then his doctor clears him, says you can go back to work as a patrol officer. The authority says, wait just 1 minute here. Before you go back to work, you are going to need to go for a fitness for duty evaluation. The phrasing is different in the case. It's described as a functional capacity exam, but essentially it is the same thing. Gibson participates in the exam. He passes. He goes back to work for 1 week, and he's off on medical leave again. Why? This time he said that the lifting that was involved in the exam aggravated his back injury. And this time, Gibson sues. And one of the important parts of this case is whether or not the authority had the right under the Americans with Disabilities Act to compel Gibson to participate in the exam. And a federal court of appeals, this is the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, disagrees with Gibson and dismissed his claim. So what does the court say? The court says, first of all, yeah, it's clear. The ADA applies to fitness for duty evaluations because the ADA explicitly says that the employer cannot require a medical examination unless it is, And here are the two standards. Unless the employer has reasons that are job-related and consistent with business necessity. So what does that mean? And the court harkens back all the way to a string of cases that includes what I think everybody in the country regards as the seminal case in the area, which is a Ninth Circuit decision called Brownfield versus City of Yakima. We'll post that one on the webpage as well. And the Sixth Circuit says, look, it's the employer's burden to prove that there is significant evidence from which a reasonable employer would want to inquire as to whether the employee was capable of performing the job. So what that means, says the court, is the employer, in this case the police chief who made the decision, had to have evidence, had to have some quantum of evidence that would cause a reasonable employer to question whether or not this employee can do the essential functions of the job. And in Gibson's case, the court says, that evidence was ample. And the chief who made the decision to require the exam was fully informed of that evidence. What's the evidence? The court points to the fact that between his two medical leaves, Gibson had missed almost a year of work. Immediately before the exam, he worked only light duty, and his doctor said he wasn't physically capable of performing all of a police officer's duties. And during the most of the time when he actually did work as a patrol officer, he had restrictions on when he could work and what physical activity he could do. That, says the court, is enough in the way of evidence to cause a reasonable police chief to determine that a fitness for duty evaluation was necessary. So just a reminder, there's nothing novel about that holding by the court. It's something that standard, the reasonable employer standard, and in particular in the context of the public safety workplace, kind of the reasonable police chief, sheriff, fire chief standard, that's the standard that applies in the country. Okay, what about the Me Too case? A little bit of factual background about this case. This comes out of Rockland County in New York, and it's a corrections case, and it involves what's known as the Superior Officers Council of the Sheriff's Correction Officers Association. That's a mouthful, but that's the name of the union. I'll probably call them the union here. Or maybe I'll call them, because it's going to become important, I'll call them the Council, the Superior Officers Council. These are supervisors. And they're parties to a collective bargaining agreement with the county. And there's a clause in the collective bargaining agreement that requires members of the council to be paid a certain percentage more than the rate of pay of corrections officers that they supervise. So if the corrections officers go out there and get a raise sometime during the term of the contract, then that means that that raise is going to have to be given to the superior officers as well. That's a Me Too clause, one of several forms of a Me Too clause you see in many collective bargaining agreements. So the county goes out and it negotiates an agreement with the Corrections Officers Union, not the Superior Officers, and it increases salary rates for the years 2016 and 2017. However, because this contract isn't negotiated until December 2017, the question comes up is, are these raises going to be retroactive? And the corrections officers agree to waive retroactivity. So there's no retroactivity under the corrections officers contract. But the superior officers then file a grievance on behalf of their members, and they say, we want the retroactivity. They're given the raises now, but they want the retroactivity that the corrections officers did not get for 2016 and 2017. The county denied the grievance on the grounds that the collective bargaining agreement didn't say anything about retroactivity, and also on the grounds that the grievance was a dead loser in the county's judgment. The association then demanded arbitration, so the county sued. And the county sought a court order preventing arbitration. And that issue ends up in an intermediate appeals court in the New York State court system. And the court says, and if you've been listening to these podcasts for a while, you can predict what the court is going to say here, which is, go ye forth and arbitrate. So what are the standards? The court says there's a two-part test. First of all, is there any statutory, constitutional, or public policy prohibition against arbitrating the grievance? Is there anything in the law that would prohibit arbitration over this topic? And the court says, no, there's nothing. There's no statute that's involved here. There's nothing about this grievance that violates public policy. May be wrong, maybe a dead loser of a grievance, but it doesn't violate public policy. So then we move to the second part of the test. And the test is, we then look at the collective bargaining agreement to see whether, in fact, the parties agreed to arbitrate the particular dispute. And the court cautions, and I'm going to quote this sentence, in examining the collective bargaining agreement, the court must merely determine whether there is a reasonable relationship between the subject matter of the dispute and the general subject matter of the agreement. If there is such a relationship, the court should rule the matter arbitrable. So in other words, this isn't a question of whether or not the contract allows the arbitration of this particular grievance. It's rather whether the grievance relates to a broad subject that is covered in the collective bargaining agreement. So now you know, again, how this case is going to come out. Let me give you the last couple of lines from the court's opinion. The arbitration provision of the contract at issue is broad, and there's a reasonable relationship between the subject matter of the dispute, me too, and the general subject matter of the contract. Although some uncertainty exists as to whether the subject matter of the dispute is encompassed within the salary provisions of the contract, or whether the parties contemplated that a separate agreement would be required for retroactivity, any alleged ambiguity in the contract regarding the coverage of any of its provisions, that's a matter of contract interpretation for the arbitrator to resolve. English language translation, you agree to final and binding arbitration in your contract? You've agreed to final and binding arbitration in your contract. Don't come to us with an argument that this particular grievance shouldn't be arbitrated because it's a loser, because it's wrong. That's for an arbitrator to decide, not for the courts to decide. I want to conclude by reminding you, we've got a couple of great seminars coming up that you ought to think about, and both of them, registrations are going pretty fast, and I'd recommend if you're interested that you check us out at LRAS.com. The first one is March 4th through 6th in Las Vegas, and it's on collective bargaining for public safety employees. This is a seminar that really gives you all of the basics, I think, that you need to prepare yourself for an upcoming bargaining session. We'll talk about everything from what are basic economic trends that are out there, what topics are mandatory for bargaining and what are not. There's an entire day spent on the nuts and bolts of the bargaining process, starting with preparing for bargaining and ending with ratification. We'll talk about things like an employer's ability to pay and comparable jurisdictions and how you assess total compensation. It's just really a very comprehensive approach to collective bargaining with great speakers. The other seminar I wanted to talk about is the first one that we've done in many years on the east side of the Rocky Mountains. We've I've wanted over the years to be on the east side of the Rocky Mountains. Many times we've tried putting seminars in places like Chicago and New York and Fort Lauderdale and Orlando and Dallas, and it turns out that public safety employees really want to go to Las Vegas more than any of those places. But we're sticking our toe in the water again. And April 15th through 17th, we're going to be in Nashville, Tennessee for our first ever health and wellness programs for public safety employees. This is one where we do anticipate this seminar selling out. We'll hit the maximum capacity on this. I'm really looking forward to this. I'm a firm believer that this approach that we're taking to wellness now is long, long overdue, and that we need to be having a much more constructive conversation about wellness in the public safety world. This seminar will involve 3 hours from me talking about wellness programs and the law, so how wellness programs impact things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, the FMLA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, and the like. You'll also hear 3 hours from Stephanie Kahn, who's, I think, become the nation's premier expert on the issue of resilience and how you increase resilience in first responders. Stephanie will be talking about primarily how does an agency and how do unions and how do employees all prepare themselves for the inevitable high-stress moments and trauma that will be associated with a public safety officer's job. How do you prepare yourself so that the impact of that trauma is not career-changing? We then have a whole day that'll be moderated by my law partner, Anil Karia, talking about what I think of as wellness programs from A to Z. Everything from how do you start a program and what do you want, what types of wellness are you looking at? Psychological wellness, physical, family wellness, financial wellness, and the like. Talking about whether or not participation should be mandatory or not. Do you need confidentiality in the program? What are the metrics for success? Anil will be hosting just a wonderful panel where we're going to have police and fire chiefs from around the country. We'll have the director of public employee assistance program from Las Vegas, Nevada. And we'll have some specialists from behavioral health sciences programs, as well as rank and file police officers who've been involved in the, and firefighters who've been involved in the development of wellness programs. It's going to be a great panel. It's going to be a jam-packed day. And then on the third day of the seminar, we're going to hear a 3-hour presentation from two individuals from the Indianapolis Office of Professional Development and Wellness in the Indianapolis Metro Police Department. Indianapolis is one of the true success stories in terms of the development of a wellness program. Thankfully, there are several that are out there right now, and we actually got to choose from several. There are places like Las Vegas and San Diego that have absolutely great wellness programs, and we selected Indianapolis because we thought it was just a wonderful example of a good wellness program produced as a result of a joint labor management effort. So, at any rate, if you can join us out there in Nashville, Tennessee, April 15th through 17th in 2020, I am not going to leave that city without getting some Nashville hot chicken from the font of all Nashville hot chicken. So, with that, thank you for joining me for this podcast. Hope to have you with us for our February 1st Thursday. And for now, this is Will Aitchison signing off.